You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Sunday, September 4th, 2016, and we are at DragonCon 2016. Joining me, as always, is Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Tara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Live long and prosper, my friends.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, DragonCon.
And we have a special guest for this show, Brian Brushwood.
I'm going to die before the episode's over.
So, Brian, tell us a little bit about what you've been doing recently. I hear you've been on TV.
Yes, as a matter of fact, you remember I did two specials of Hacking the System when we did a full season on National Geographic. That recently hit Netflix, and it's as though it came out for the first time. Everybody's like, oh, man, you have a TV show. It's like, yeah, why didn't you watch last year? It was amazing. But that's available right now. Hacking the System is on Netflix. It's a lot of fun. People are asking about season two, which we're moving forward on under the name The Modern Rogue. So if you go to themodernrogue.com, we get to do all the extremely irresponsible, dangerous stuff that National Geographic wouldn't let us do.
Awesome. I was just telling Brian that I was like in bed 11 o'clock at night in my underwear. I'm going through Netflix and I'm like, that's Brushwood. Oh my God.
It's very comforting to know that that's when you're thinking of me.
You were in bed with me and my wife that night.
Right, so I'm going to have a sip of this.
All right, so when we do our DragonCon show, we often like to talk about costumes and interesting things. Evan, how many times did people come up to you and like really think that you were Adam Savage?
I lost count at about 36. I stopped counting at about that, and I'm not making that number up.
How does that conversation go when you're walking disappointment?
Typically. Well, that's exactly what it is. Right. I have to break it to these people that I'm not Adam Savage. They're crestfallen.
He's very used to that. Mirrors his Adam Savage costume.
Tell me at least once you let somebody believe. You gave them that gift.
A couple people refused to believe it. I don't know if they were half drunk or half in the bag or something, but they just kept carrying on a conversation as if I was Adam.
So you're saying they were skeptical.
I will tell you just one thing, though. So last night, that exactly happened to me. A guy came up to me, starts talking, and I'm not Adam Savage. I'm Evan Bernstein. I'm with the Skeptics. Okay. Oh, he says, yeah, okay, I know the Skeptics Guide to the Universe. So how are you related to the Bernstein and the Skeptics Guide to the Universe?
Very closely. One thing that's interesting looking at the costumes is trying to think about what kind of costume do you find most interesting. Evan's costume is one where you start with where you sort of look like somebody and then you go with that, right? So there's like a Scotty, like you guys have seen the Scotty, like the guy who does Montgomery Scott every year because he already looks like him. I saw a perfect Peter Capaldi doctor who like already, the guy already looks like him. And Merlin, if anyone went into Merlin.
And there was a guy that looked like Littlefinger from Game of Thrones.
Yeah, Littlefinger.
I thought it was the actor. Size, yeah. I thought it was the actor for a few nanoseconds.
Yeah. So those are fun. But there's some other themes of costumes. There's the obscure costume. Oh, God. Extra points for anybody who gets that reference.
Raise your hand.
Let me take a look.
Wow.
So nobody. Wow. So this was my daughter, Autumn. This is a video game that she plays. It's called Mad Father. There we go, Mad Father. Okay. Thank you, sir. These are all characters. We've got one Autumn, one person recognized.
Steve, that falls into the category of too obscure.
Hey, who knows?
No such animal.
All right. Then there's the popular costumes, like from popular TV shows. Actually, there's so many themes going on in this one picture.
So much wrong.
This is a great one. So then there's the minimalist costume.
I like this one. All right. Sometimes you look at a minimalist costume, you're like, why did you even do this? Why? But that, I liked it because clearly this person doesn't necessarily want to get into full costume and go crazy, but they're showing their passion. I don't know, what is that thing? It's adorable, this cute little
Futurama.
That's right.
Brain Slugger Futurama.
Wait, so Bob, you're the one saying how much you love this and you didn't even know what the costume was?
But we're talking about themes, Jay. This is the minimalist theme.
Jay, that's because Bob has his own brain slug.
What it is irrelevant. It's the theme. It's minimal, and I liked it. I kind of liked it.
No, perfect. When your brain is dead, stun doesn't work.
Jay, my phaser is so much bigger than your phaser. Come on, David.
Okay.
Right.
Don't want to go ahead.
Yeah, Bob's overcompensating. Okay, so I like the group costumes. And this one's very, there's also a few things going on here. It's trendy, right, with the Pokemon. It's a group costume. And there's definitely a class of costume that is primarily about showing how sexy you are, right? That's it. That's the reason for the costume, and everyone knows it. And you know it, and you want people to know it, and it works.
The 300 guys. That
yeah, the 300 guys.
Yeah, sure. They do it the best. They work out. Someone was just telling me that those guys actually work out virtually with each other for a year. Like, they call each other and like they're preparing for
to get up to 300 level. Yeah. I like the mashups, you know, the hybrid costumes. Like, I don't know, what are these guys? Medieval stormtroopers? Or
I'm surprised that we didn't see a Jon Snow stormtrooper. Seems like being all in black with that giant feathery, crow cape would have been badass. Someone steal that idea.
Yeah.
I did see a Planet of the Apes mask with a stormtrooper outfit, and I thought that was awesome.
That was awesome.
Yeah, those are the ones that make you stop and think. Like, there was one group of guys who were in Star Trek uniforms, but they were like Indians, right? They had
American Indians.
Yeah, like American Indians, but Star Trek. Right. Instead of phasers, they had slingshots.
Oh, got it.
I don't like it.
Whatever. It's interesting. Yeah, Bob's a purist.
But Bob likes the woman that looks completely dejected with the green thing on her head.
were they laser slingshots? Were they what?
They were slingshots. That was their weapon.
Okay.
They were genre appropriate weapons. Okay. So this is not at Dragon Con. This is unfortunately real. You're looking at a picture of a lot of dead reindeer, and Kara is going to tell us this uplifting, life affirming story to get us started.
Man, Steve, thanks for the setup. So yeah, you guys, if you've like been alive for the past week, if you've been on the internet at all, you've probably come across this insane story that in a field in Norway, 323 reindeer were found dead, and apparently they all died in an instant. It turns out that the most likely culprit here was lightning. The big question is, how do 323 reindeer die at the same time because of a lightning strike? And there's a handful of reasons that the experts investigating this case have come up with. One is that reindeer tend to huddle together during thunderstorms, so they're kind of out in the open already, and then now they're in very close quarters. Another one is that lightning exhibits a phenomenon called ground current. So when lightning strikes and it actually does go cloud to ground completely, generally a current is going to run through the ground underneath the reindeer's feet. And in this case, the diameter was somewhere between 150 and 250 feet that was affected by this lightning strike. Also, hoofstock, like reindeer and other quadrupeds, are especially vulnerable. They've got 4 feet on the ground, so they've got more points of contact, and their feet are spread wider apart than, let's say, human feet, which are really side by side. The way that the circuit continues is it generally is going to run from the point of contact through the ground up a foot, hit the heart, and come back down through another foot and continue the circuit. So the wider apart the legs are, apparently the better it can travel. Now, nobody knows if this was one strike or if it was multiple strikes, but witnesses do say that the kind of group death happened in a single moment. In investigating this, I found some other numbers that are kind of interesting. Here's some records for the number of animals that died in one fell swoop from a lightning strike. 68 cows, that would be a bummer day for that farmer. 53 pigs.
Not if he's hungry.
What?
Not if he's hungry.
Yeah, well, yeah. Pre-cooked. 53 pigs, 143 goats, and a weather almanac entry from Utah in 1918 reports that, quote, two large bolts of lightning struck and killed 654 head of sheep on Mill Canyon Peak in American Fork Canyon. There was a 75-foot swath in between the dead sheep and the ones that were not injured. and the dead sheep had to be moved to the opposite side of the canyon so as to be off the watershed. There's a lot of questions about what to do in this case. Usually if an animal dies naturally in a field in Norway, you would just let it kind of decompose, right, and fertilize the ground. These are wild animals. They're not domesticated animals. But when so many die at once, it can actually pose a bit of a threat. So I think they're still kind of working on that.
You know, Kara, the science, I know scientists went and checked this out and everything, but I have another theory. I think that these deer actually opened the Ark of the Covenant.
I think they all just found out there's no Santa Claus.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, Jay. Because if they opened the Ark of the Covenant, their bodies wouldn't be left behind, right? They would have all disappeared.
Oh, I didn't. Yeah, I did. Right. Yeah. I stand corrected.
Yeah, okay.
So one thing that kind of struck me when I was reading about this is I started thinking, you know, what happens when you get struck by lightning as a person? Because it does happen.
So, Kara, have there been any cases of multiple people dying from lightning?
Oh, I didn't find any examples of multiple people.
Imagine if 500 people dropped dead from one lightning strike.
Super rare, but it's interesting that you said 500 people, because that's about the average count per year that die of lightning strike across the world. So far this year, 32 people have died in the U.S. But it's super rare. Your chance of getting struck by lightning across your lifespan is about 1 in 12,000. It's probably not going to happen to you.
That doesn't sound rare enough for my taste.
Yeah, it's not as rare as most people think, which is why it's a great... That's more likely than getting struck by lightning. Or that's like your chances of getting struck by lightning are greater than winning the lottery. Yeah, by orders of magnitude.
Yeah, you should change that to getting eaten by a shark or something. That's like a better standard there. It's way less. But about 450 out of those 500, so around 90% of the people who get struck by lightning survive to tell the tale. So I wanted to look into...
You said 95%?
90%.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I wanted to see what happens. You know, what happens when you get struck by lightning? It's very similar to what happened to these. You guys may have seen this, but there are these telltale signs of lightning strike called Lichtenberg figures. And they're these zigzaggy scars that people end up with on their skin. And it's...
Or on their forehead.
Or on their forehead. Yeah. And it's understood at this point that these are burn marks that indicate the exact path that the actual electricity took, kind of the path of least resistance across your skin. So here's just a couple little factoids. Lightning can superheat the air around it up to 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 5 times hotter than the surface of the sun. It happens in a flash, but it's very, very hot.
That's another one of those misleading comparisons. It's always hotter than the surface of the sun. Because the surface of the sun is not the hottest part of the sun.
No, not the core. Not
it's
the core.
The corona is like millions of degrees.
Oh, yeah, or the corona.
Yeah, so, but it sounds really impressive. You think the surface of the sun, that's got to be the hottest. It's actually not. So you could, anyway, it's a very, very common trope to make that slightly misleading comparison.
Yeah,
it's still freaking hot.
Five times hotter than that.
Yeah.
And it can cause, obviously, permanent damage, like singeing your hair, singeing your clothing. Apparently, if you have piercings, like I do, these become points of contact, and you actually can get really severe burns around any metal that's on your body. And, of course, you may suffer cardiac arrest, motor symptoms.
Yeah, that's what kills you. It stops your heart.
Yeah, neurological damage can be persistent. You just got to think back to your biology classes, what we think of as excitable tissue, right? Tissue that actually requires and reacts to these sort of electrical charges, these changes in the ions across the membrane. These tissues specifically can be very negatively affected by a lightning strike. So it's not uncommon that even though people survive to tell the tale, they do have lasting damage to their brain, and sometimes they have to have their hearts restarted.
Mm-hmm. Those don't sound like superpowers.
No.
Yeah, they don't get superpowers. Yeah, that would be nice.
Not common.
Kara, a lot of these hits, are they direct hits or are they those ground hits that people experience?
Oh, when people are individually struck by lightning? I would assume that, a lot of them, there's actually a website that I looked at that kind of tallies all of the American lightning strikes, and a lot of them would be dude on a jet ski. I think it's having some sort of a lightning rod somehow attached to you, an unexpected lightning rod, or being near a large body of water, which is obviously very conducting for electricity. Or even a small body of water.
Yeah. And being on the ground, and often it's raining when it's lightning, so the ground is wet, so it's a good conductor. People also die from stepping on the ground if there's a down power line, because the ground is a good enough conductor. If there is a down power line or if it's lightning, your best bet is to be within an enclosed space, especially an enclosed conducting space, because then that's essentially a Faraday cage.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're in your car, stay in the car. Because cars are pretty good.
They're grounded. They have rubber. Don't touch
the outside, and you're pretty good. If you're in, like, a trailer, because trailer parks get hit with everything, right? So just stay in the trailer. I mean, there are cases of people who, like, stepped outside their trailer, their foot hits the ground, and they're dead, you know, so because there was a down power line or something. Just that's a safety tip, you know, don't stay inside. Jay and Evan and I actually were right next to a lightning strike a couple of weekends ago. We were, you know, outside. We must have been like 50, 100 feet at most away from...
Wow.
Yeah, it was not far at all.
It's like to the back of this room, right?
Yeah. Wow.
You hear it when you see it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like you said, there was no delay. It was zero delay.
But wait, no, because my experience was we heard a little electrical, like a charring sound, and then a little firecracker. And I turned to these guys, I'm like, what the hell was that? And they're like, it was a lightning strike. Then it was like, blah!
No, but there was like a pre-sound, yeah, you know, to the
you
light.
You actually heard kind of the crackle of the lightning.
Yeah, which you usually don't hear. You hear the thunderous explosion, but there's a softer pre-electrical, like a circuit, you know, and we heard that because we were so close to it. That was cool.
That was cool.
Yeah, that was cool. It was cool because nobody died. Yeah, we were all inside. Okay. Have you guys heard of the space train? Also called the Solar Express.
That's the funky new dance, right?
Not the Soul Train.
The Soul Train is actually more interesting. Okay. So this is an idea. This is actually not a new idea. A gentleman who was sold as a Montreal-based innovator. I'm an innovator. That's what I am. That's his job description. Charles Bombardier. Came up with this idea for the Solar Express that he's shopping around. The idea is that you have a large spaceship that is on a loop, right? It could be, like, say, from the Earth to Mars. It would be one common loop. And it just goes around. It never stops, you know. And then you just hitch a ride on the train, and then that takes you to your destination, and you get off.
Wait, to clarify, hitching a ride means you have to speed up to it, right? It's going really fast. You speed up to it, then you dock.
Then it continues to take you. You dock with it, and then you undock at your destination, and then you go down to where you need to go. So that's fine. That idea is actually pretty old. I mean, people have been talking about that, and there's huge advantages to that. Like, for example, let's say it takes 3 months to get from the Earth to Mars. That's 3 months in a small cramped ship with questionable shielding, or you could be in a large luxury ship with artificial, you know, with rotating section to produce artificial gravity and massive shielding and lots of space and lots of supplies. You can take a tiny shuttle that just holds you. It's like a really small shuttle that is just for, like, whatever, 5 passengers, 7 passengers. So it's carrying no supplies, minimal shielding, so very, very lightweight, could accelerate up to and dock with the train, right, the space train. And then once you're docked with it, then you're on the luxury ship for the 3 months to Mars with the shielding and the food and all the good stuff, right? So that's the idea. That's the idea of this, is that it's great for people traveling long distance in space, so you could take that trip on an ideal ship. But, it costs a lot of energy to accelerate the big ship up to a fast speed and then decelerate it at your destination. So this way, you only have to accelerate and decelerate the tiny shuttle, but the big ship stays at the fast speed, so it's very energy efficient. So that's almost certainly what we're going to be doing, right? That makes just so much sense. It's very efficient. So NASA's already way ahead of this guy. But the reason why I saw it was going around the press, because this guy, you know, wrote a paper where he's saying, or in just like an article, he was saying, we could accelerate this space train, my Solar Express, up to 1% of the speed of light, which is 3,000 kilometers per second. And at that speed, you can get from Earth to Mars in 2 days. They said we could use this to also to ferry goods, you can attach cargo sections onto, I can see the picture, like there's different sections. Like one could be a cargo section, you could have passenger sections, you could link them up and just send them to Mars. But he's totally missing the point of the space train, right? So first of all, you would never use this idea for cargo, because cargo doesn't need water and shielding and space. It would be a waste. The other thing I think he's missing is that, as Jay said, if once you match your orbit with the ship so that you can dock with it, you're on your way to Mars, right? Yeah. That's it. If you don't have to dock, and then it's not taking you to Mars. You're already going to Mars. The only point is that you're just stepping over into a bigger ship that you'd rather live in than your little shuttle.
Unless we develop transporter technology, then you could just transport onto the ship. But
yeah.
Or you could just transport. Why would you need a ship?
Yeah, you could transport to Mars.
You're thinking small, Bob.
A transporter is small?
Why would you transport to the ship if you could just transport to Mars?
That's too far away. Come on.
Can we keep this discussion of transporter technology serious, please?
The other thing I just thought of, Steve, is, all right, you've got this building-sized ship traveling to and from the Earth at 1% the speed. Do you want a building coming at the Earth at 1% the speed of light, like every 2 days?
No, the 1% the speed of light is ridiculous.
That's the ludicrous part. I don't want my physical body to be subjected to that velocity. Like, what would that do to you, going 1% the speed of light?
Nothing. The speed itself is nothing. It's the acceleration.
It's the acceleration.
Yeah.
And deacceleration.
Yeah. But the other thing is, very quick, if you're getting to Mars in 2 days, you don't need the big ship, right? Just stay in your small ship. You're only going to be 2 days, right? The only point is if it takes 3 months, that's when you need the big ship. So again, he's got to totally reverse. And it's like, you can get to the moon in 2 minutes. Okay.
I'm surprised to hear you guys even thinking of it in terms of a ship, because it seems like obviously what you want to do is hollow out an asteroid and have a persistent, you know, something about the size of Manhattan that makes its own water, has its own tiny biome ecosystem. And yes, it just does keep making this lap. And, you know, you go spend six months in Manhattan, and then you get off and you're on Mars. Yeah. And then you spend 6 months in Manhattan to go back.
Yeah, absolutely. Hollowed out asteroids is another thing that's been talked about for a long time in science fiction and in space circles. Absolutely, because you have your shielding built in, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And gravity, if you're just spinning it the whole way as
if
well.
If you spin it up, right, that's like the movie, the TV show, The Expanse. They spun up series or something. So it's still only like 20% Earth gravity, and their bones are all brittle and everything, but it's not bad, you know?
Also, just the general idea, Steve, how efficient would this really be? I mean, it's not like you're going to be in orbit around Earth, the Earth-Mars system. You're going to have fuel to accelerate, decelerate, change your trajectory to make the path back to the Earth and back to the Mars. It's not a stable orbit.
Yeah, right.
Satellite.
Because Earth and Mars are moving. Yeah, so
But they're not. But the thing is, they're just jockeying it at that point.
Yeah, it's just like little booster adjustments,
refinements.
Right?
Yeah, that's no big deal.
It's not the same as like what's required for launch.
And if you really play your cards right, and NASA is good at this, you know, you swing around Mars in just the right way to send you back to wherever is going to intercept Earth. They're really good at that orbital mechanics.
At 1% the speed of light.
No, I think the 1% the speed of light thing is BS.
Yes.
That's never going to happen. Is what's the point? You know, I guess if you were going to Proxima Centauri, you know, then sure. Or even like the Kuiper Belt or something. But to get to Mars, no, it would just be pointless. And yeah, it's too fast to deal with. First of all, you won't have the time or space to accelerate your shuttle up to that speed. Again, you'd be at Mars. You know?
Yeah, you'd never be able to dock. I mean, that would be the craziest. You guys remember The Martian. Yeah. Do you remember how hard it was for him to dock with? They were right there. They weren't even going that fast.
Yeah, and plus you got to factor in acceleration time and deacceleration time. So you know, at that speed, you wouldn't have probably enough time to get up to speed and then retract that speed.
Yeah, but he's talking as if, like, you get to the ship and it takes you on this fast journey and then you just drop off.
You're not getting off a bus, pal.
Yeah, okay? Right. Exactly.
Real quick, just to give the benefit of the doubt, let's say you have something big enough that it has its own gravity well, right? Then all of a sudden, let's say you don't even care. You just need to transport ice and minerals and whatever stuff. So you have payloads that are basically like picture of this rock is making its orbit, right, doing its loop. And then you're like, we need to get more oxygen over there. We need to get more water. So you set up a bunch of essentially, rail guns that just shoot a bunch of stuff that just get close enough that it falls into the gravity well of this. And so they're like little, peas that go. And it all just attaches on the outside, comes around the side, and then now you have everything collected. And so, people go out on the surface, and as they get closer, they're swinging by Mars, and they start just flinging it down to the surface. I mean, you are functionally moving raw materials that are needed, and there's a reason for that to work. I don't know. It seems like there might be something to it.
Yeah, you're essentially then using a gravity assist, right? So you are using the gravity of a large body in order to accelerate or decelerate stuff. Right. So that's basically what you're talking about.
Essentially making it a mass driver. And because that's the other thing is you put the stuff on there and it slows down and you use solar winds to speed it back up. And then, you decelerate and you affect your path by, which direction you're throwing off stuff. And it all generally gets around Mars and then people pick it up.
Right. But you got to get your momentum from somewhere, right? So either you're shooting a rocket or using an ion drive or solar sails or gravity, right? Those are the ways that you accelerate and decelerate stuff. And then when you arrive, if you're arriving at a planet with an atmosphere, you can use atmospheric braking as well to, to decelerate. Yeah. Mars is like interesting because it has just enough of an atmosphere to be a pain in the ass, but not enough to really be useful for braking. So it's actually a really challenging planet to land stuff on. Earth is easier because we have a thicker atmosphere, so you could brake in our atmosphere.
Sky crane,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
What do you guys think of Elon Musk's plan to just drop a few nukes on the poles, fill up all that atmosphere?
Yeah. I don't think that's even his plan. Yeah. I think it's like something he mentioned once.
Right.
Dude, that dude is going to die in a lair on Mars. I think it's a plan.
I really don't know. I didn't read any of the science behind it. I don't even know if there's legitimate science behind it.
There's not enough nukes to do that on the planet. Like, yeah, it's really... It would require a lot more firepower than we currently have.
That's a Tasmanian devil.
That is the Tasmanian devil.
Tell us what's going on with these guys.
Well, they're dying. I mean, they're infected with cancer is basically what's happening. So just the past 20 years, this now endangered species has lost 80% of its population. 80% of them are gone. Due to a contagious version of a cancer called devil facial tumor disease, DFTD. So obviously it starts in the facial area, but it can badly affect other parts of the devil's body, and it spreads through and it kills these things in just a matter of 3 to 5 months once they contract it. It's really bad. Now the animal's highly social yet fierce temperament, as we all know from watching the cartoons, right? It helps the disease spread. So in other words, because of their social rituals that they do, they bite each other on the face, and therefore they pass the cancer on from one to the other. As DFTD is one of only three contagious cancers found in the wild. The cancerous cells are passed directly between devils as an allograft, which is essentially the cancer cells of parasites.
And so allo just means it comes from somebody else.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
By your own cells.
So they're studying the problem, and they've shown that the Tasmanian devils have failed to recognize, once they're bit, the Tasmanian devil is not infected. Once it is bit and it picks up the cancer cells, I mean, normally in nature with a lot of animals, what happens is your immune system says, okay, these are not my cells, I'm just going to fight them off and get away with it. But with the Tasmanian devil, their immune system can't determine the difference between the two. And so it thinks it's its own cells that these cancer cells belong to them, and they take them in, and there you have it, it's contracted cancer. When the scientists first realized that this was going on 20 years ago, they thought these critters would be totally, totally wiped out by now. No way that these things would have lived 20 years. But in some geographical pockets, devil populations are still alive and thriving. So what's so special about these pockets of devils that they seem to be immune to the effects of the cancer? The scientists looked at hundreds of devil genomes from three different sites in Tasmania and compared them with genomes from animals living decades ago when DFTD hadn't yet run rampant like it is now. And they found that the modern survivors had changes in their genes, five of which were related to cancer or immune functions. So the scientists think that the genes are probably protecting these pockets of devils from that cancer and helping their immune system fight it off.
I think you buried the lead. The reason they're biting faces, according to the article I read, it was on the internet, but is that they have exceptionally rough sex. There's a lot of biting of faces.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, part of the sex act.
Yeah, to them, that's the best part.
So no vanilla for the devils, huh?
Is that a sexually transmitted disease then?
Oh, jeez.
Interesting.
I guess so.
Wow,
so, I mean, this is evolution.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a great example of evolution. It's a good one to sort of keep in the filing cabinet because this is how evolution often works. Remember, it's population genetics, right? So you have a range of a species will have a range, right? And across that range, there are going to be different subpopulations. And it may not necessarily be very, very discrete, or it could be if there's geographical separation. And then under some kind of stress, which could be this, a disease or an infection or a drought or whatever, some subset of that population just happens to be better adapted to the new threat the new situation. And then, you know, 80%, 90%, 95% of the broader population dies out, but this one subpopulation survives, and they become the next iteration of that species. And you just do that a million times, you know, and you got something really serious going on. So it's actually a really great example of how evolution works. It's not so much on individuals as it is the just subpopulations competing with each other, and as the situation changes, you know, often at random, those that are better adapted survive. And because there's such populations are often spread out across a huge range, there's a lot of variability. Again, we tend to oversimplify things in our mind, you know, like we think of a species as being this very narrow type. And in fact, prior to Darwin, this is still the case, but it, you know, in, just because of, I think, a historical contingency, but naturalists would try to determine, like, for every species, there was the index species, there was the index samples, right? So like this male and this female, that is the species, right?
It's like usually the first one discovered.
Yeah, like there's a physical specimen that represents the species. But the whole idea was that you could represent an entire species with one male and one female, right, sample. But that's, we clearly know that that's not true, that you need hundreds of samples to show the range of variation across the populations. Species even blend into each other often if there's enough continuity out there.
Yeah, wolves and dogs. Yeah. You know, wolves can mate with dogs and have viable offspring.
Sure.
And if you look within the Canis domesticus, as we all know, a Chihuahua and a Great Dane are the same species. And if I were an anthropologist, I would be very confused by that.
Right.
Steve, though, I'm listening to what you're saying, but I'm just thinking here, like, well, who would win in a fight, a honey badger or a Tasmanian devil?
That's all he's been thinking about this whole time. I think something that's really interesting about this story is that we're seeing evolution on a mammalian scale, because within our lifespan, that's often hard to do. We see evolution a lot with bacteria, right? Antibiotic-resistant bacteria is a good example, because they have such a quick lifespan. They replicate so quickly. Mammals often, you know, they grow old, they die, and it takes a while for us to see big population changes. So it's very cool to be able to see this sort of in real time.
Yeah.
And Steve, what about the genetic strategies for dealing the way that the devil's been dealing with the cancer?
What do you mean, like mutations?
Can we learn from that?
Sure, but that's under investigation.
Sure.
Yeah, so we'll see in 5-10 years.
Absolutely. Right.
Okay, so we're looking at a picture of a fat frog. You may think that that's what it's called, but Carrie, you sent this to us. Tell us what's going on here.
So I found this really great hashtag on Twitter, the internet names animals. And there were a lot of really great examples of people renaming animals, so we thought that we'd play with some ourselves. So when I saw him, I mean, I thought, Jabba the what? So I see that.
Right, this has been a meme running through our show this year, the whole internet naming stuff, like Bodie McBoatface kind of started it off. And it's, you know, it's interesting because the whole idea of crowdsourcing has interesting strengths and weaknesses. But it's like this, I think, coming up with the funniest stuff, I think, is great for crowdsourcing.
Yeah. Oh,
right.
Yeah.
So this is basically what this is. I like Jabba the What. That was good. This you might not realize this, but this is a sea panda. What do you got? I don't have one for this.
Yeah, I have one for each of these, but I think this one was less appropriate.
This is what's known as the tropical face.
I'm glad we didn't say the inappropriate.
I know. Oh,
yeah. So I don't have pictures for everyone, but a couple of my favorites. One of my favorite was a snake is actually a danger noodle. And this is one of my favorite, too. That's an American murder log. Or an alligator, for those listening at home. This is mine, the one I came up with. That's a stretch pony.
Stretch pony!
Stretch pony.
Cute.
And I found the perfect picture for it. There's also one I thought of, but I didn't get a picture for it. And tell me what you think this is. I'll tell you what the name is. You tell me what it is. It's a pointy water cow. Pointy water cow.
Evan Burns.
A narwhal. Very good.
Narwhal.
Like
it. Yep. Yeah.
That was it. Okay.
Oh, man, this is all new to me. I got a whole meme to dive into now. Yeah. This is incredible.
All right. I said I can't talk right now. I'm doing the podcast. Yeah, yeah. I'll meet you in a Jeffrey's tube. Take your clothes off. I'll be there in about a half an hour.
Jay, it's not a cell phone. It's a communicator. You hold it in front of your face.
And we all get to hear what's on the other side.
All right, Jay. I understand Juno is getting closer to Jupiter.
Juno? Yeah. So Juno is the space probe we sent on July 5th, 2016. So yeah, it went and they're having it go over the North Pole. Went over the North Pole and they took images for I think about 2 hours. It was at 120,000 miles and it snapped this picture and a ton of other pictures, which is really cool. You know, we live in a good time because you know we have machines that are really fleshing out our solar system now in a way that you know people could only imagine you know even 10-15 years ago. You know, this was 120,000 miles above, but we've been as close as 2,600 miles above, which I think is really cool. Juno is, you know, its altitude is changing to take different kind of pictures. And 1974, Pioneer 11 was the last time that we took pictures of the pole, but they were nowhere near the quality that we're seeing here, which is awesome.
Oh, wow. Galileo didn't get the pole?
I don't think so, no.
Oh, that's crazy.
And this sucks, but in 20 months or less, I think it's less than 20 months, now we're going to deorbit Juno. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah. It's going to fall into Jupiter.
Yep.
Yeah. Which Galileo did, too.
Yeah.
But Galileo did some science on the way down. Does Juno have any, do you know?
I don't know, anybody know?
I think Juno's prime directive is not even photography, right? I mean, that was like an afterthought to throw those cameras on Juno. So I think there is probably some very good science.
Yeah, there's got to be. If you're going to deorbit it into Jupiter, you better have a plan to take some measurements while on your way in.
Sure. But it's got to have, you know, the ability to send us that information before it burns up, right? But anyway, I mean, Galileo was able to survive for quite a while. All right, Bob, I understand something exciting happened in the Milky Way not too long ago.
Yeah. So cosmologists, trying to solve one mystery, they may have actually solved two mysteries, two for the price of one. They were trying to find out where the hell the missing mass of the Milky Way was, and they may have found a period of time when our galactic core went kind of crazy. Let's tackle the first mystery, the missing mass. Astronomers have known for a long time that there's something wrong with the mass of our galaxy. They calculate that there's about 1 to 2 trillion solar masses in the Milky Way. And that's a big error bar, isn't it? 1 to 2 trillion? Whatever. So you've got 1 to 2 trillion solar masses. So 5/6 of that, that's dark matter. Just take that away. So 1/6 of that mass is stuff, stars, gas,
but that's
things that we can see.
That's amazing in and of itself, though. So just keep in mind, they're looking at the galaxy and how it's rotating. This is when they discovered dark matter. And they're only seeing a tiny fraction of the matter that should exist in the galaxy. And even when they calculate it all out about how much physical matter should be in the galaxy, we're still missing 80%. And that's still what dark matter is, just the stuff that's missing that we should be seeing, but we're not.
Am I understanding it correctly? Like, specifically, this is the matter that should be there for galaxies to move the way they seem to move. It's the motion of the galaxy that implies that there's more mass than we see.
The rotation of the galaxy because of, you know, Kepler's laws of motion, basically. So essentially, the stars should be moving more slowly as they get farther out, but because there's more matter, there's more matter within the orbit of each star as you get farther and farther out from the center of the galaxy. They're moving at roughly the same speed. But that's, you know, in order for that to happen, in order for those stars, the outer stars to be going the velocity they're going, we need to have 5 times as much matter in the galaxy as should be there. Otherwise, the stars will be flinging out of the galaxy at their current speed.
Right.
So it's got to be there. The gravity's got to be there.
And that's not the only, like, line of evidence. Now we know, based on, like, some other lensing, measurements.
Sure.
There's a lot of different lines
of
evidence.
Absolutely. And this isn't even a dark matter topic, so I'm not sure why we're spending so much time.
Well, hold on, Bob.
That's awesome.
Bob, before you start, though, I just want people, as a point of reference, the bright stars that are on the outer left, Tatooine is near that third star. That's called the outer rim. Now, towards the bright spot, Alderaan is in that inner core where all the rich planets are.
They told you this was a galaxy far, far away.
Right. Yeah, it's the wrong galaxy.
This is the wrong franchise.
That was actually the Delta Quadrant where the Klingons are, Jay.
Oh,
there
gotcha.
You go.
Sorry.
There you go.
Sorry, wrong Star Trek.
Okay, back to science.
So Bob's just sitting there annoyed, you know, the whole time.
Oh, he's pissed off at all of us. After the show, he's going to go, what the hell, guys? That was my topic. I'm not kidding.
I know what you're going to cut in post-production. It better be that stuff and not this stuff that's coming right now. So you got, all right, 5/6 of this 1 to 2 trillion solar masses. Dark matter. Okay, we already beat that to death. So 1/6 of that is normal matter. Stars, gas, dust, whatever. And so the thing is, though, there should be about 150 to 300 million solar masses of that. That's fine. But we can only find 65 billion solar masses of it.
Yeah,
65 billion. So there's 100 to 200 billion solar masses. Where is this? It should be there, but it's not there. So where the hell is it? So the scientist said, so we played a game of cosmic game and hide and seek. We asked ourselves, where could the missing mass be hiding? So they looked at archived X-ray data from probes and satellites and observatories, and they found that, it seems pretty fast, but they found this fog of gas, superheated million-degree gas, permeating the galaxy.
Is it hotter than the surface of the sun?
Many times hotter.
Far, far hotter. So million degrees. And if you add up the mass of this fog, it's about 130 billion solar masses.
There
so that accounts for most, or perhaps even all, but at least most of this missing mass. So that's great. They have a viable candidate for the missing mass. But when they looked at this fog and they looked at their models, they're like, wait a second. There's a bubble of no gas surrounding the core in the middle of the entire galaxy with 40,000 light year diameter. There's no gas there. There's kind of like a torus or a donut shaped expanding shell of this gas, but there's nothing in the middle.
That's where God lives. That was in Star Trek, right? They went to the core and
Five.
We don't talk about Star Trek 5. So the thing is, what could possibly clear this out? The most viable candidate is that you had some craziness going on at the core. And so what happened was 4 to 6 million years ago when our hominin ancestors were walking the Earth, the Sagittarius A, our supermassive black hole, was going crazy. There was a feeding frenzy of gas, kind of the opposite of you, Jay. Come on.
I'm fine with that.
All right. Is that written on a notepad? Were you waiting for that one?
Oh, I've got it written down right here. And underlined and in bold.
I fart, and so do you. Okay?
I don't revel in it like you do.
My daughters have a book for the other, everybody poops, right? It's really everybody farts.
So you've got the core of the galaxy having a feeding frenzy, but how is stuff actually being pushed out or getting out? Black holes can have outflows. It kind of doesn't make sense because you think black holes suck. They don't blow, right? How does that even happen? Technically, they don't suck. I know that. But I was wondering, how could you have such a massive outflow when a black hole is just pulling everything in? And they're not quite sure exactly how these outflows work. It could be radiation pressure pushing the gas out. It could be some complicated interplay between the relativistic jets that come out of the poles and the interstellar medium and magnetic field. So it's complicated, but you do have these outflows, and they've seen that in plenty of other galaxies.
Yeah, I feel like the term outflow makes it sound like it's sort of leaking, but you said it might have something to do with these polar ejecta?
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
Because we know that exists.
Yeah, we know that. Yeah, but they go kind of perpendicular to the plane of the galaxy. How is it flowing outward within the plane? But there's some kind of interplay. They think there's lots of theories. I'm not even sure, but they do know by looking at all these other galaxies that there is this outflow. So there you have it. We know we have a good candidate for the missing mass, and now we kind of have an idea that the Milky Way was an AGN, an active galactic nuclei, or maybe a minor one. 4 to 6 million years ago, and that's fascinating because we didn't really know that it had such an active phase.
It's not active now?
Oh, no, because all that gas was pushed away, and it's like it's quiescent now. It's totally, you know, it has a little burp every now and then, but there's not much. And so one other thing I found extraordinarily horrific reporting on this, Sputnik News. I went to Sputnik News, and this is what they said about what I just told you. Okay, the scientists think the fog is powered by the high-energy explosion of the star that went on to become the supermassive black hole. The star that became the supermassive black hole. That's ridiculous. A star doesn't become a supermassive black hole. We're talking millions of solar masses at least. Some of them have billions. To me, that was pretty egregious.
Yeah, it's just bad reporting.
It was bad. And then
they didn't put star parenthesis S close parenthesis.
No, not at all.
So then the last line they had here was, since the shockwave of the explosion has traveled 20,000 light years of space, they calculated that the black hole exploded 6 million years ago. That's less wrong, but still kind of goofy. Mm. Black holes don't explode, but the activity around it can be interpreted as explosion. But I was like, I really just like caught my attention. Like, wow, that's an epic fail that I don't see very often in these types of news items.
Really? You don't see that often?
Not that big. Not like that.
Yeah.
A star becoming super black, maybe that doesn't sound crazy to you, but I was like, whoa.
No. I think you'd probably go to better news sources for your astronomy news.
Okay, true.
If you go to more generic sources, that's exactly what you find. Like, stuff that are totally confusing. Like, what's a galaxy? What's a solar system? And what's a star? I mean, it's amazing. Like, no idea of, like, how the universe is put together. That's what I typically see. Yeah. In just mainstream science news reporting, that's more par for the course. All right, Kara, I believe it's time for What's the Word?
All right. Well, the word this week is thanatosis. Anybody in the audience? You guys know it already? Any ecologists, zoologists? Yeah, we got a few there.
I think I saw somebody in a thanatosis costume.
Yeah.
Isn't that a supervillain?
So this was sent in by a listener, Ben Kay from Hyattsville, Maryland. The definition of thanatosis is the cessation of all voluntary activity and assumption of a posture of apparent death. So you'll also hear it known as playing dead, feigning death, apparent death, tonic immobility, or playing possum. That's where that phrase comes from. So thanatosis occurs in a lot of reptile and insect species, especially beetles. Beetles are apparently really epic at this. Some amphibians and even mammals like the possum. Thanatos is actually a Greek root meaning death, and some linguists argue that the more appropriate term would actually be thanatopsis, because the suffix opsis actually refers to sight, so death sight or this, you know, looking dead seems to be a more appropriate term, but we actually do say thanatosis. And in fact, thanatopsis is the name of a famous poem by William Cullen Bryant. He wrote it in 1811. When I was digging about thanatosis, I started reading about early descriptions of it before the term was actually used. In the 1600s, this behavior was actually described in the literature as animal hypnosis, because handlers would encounter when they would, you know, pick up an animal or otherwise kind of get in the animal's way, that they would feign death, and they thought that they were hypnotizing them. So you'll see that term used in a lot of older citations, and then thanatosis became the more scientific term for it.
Have you ever seen a possum playing dead?
No.
I've seen a possum gape, which is what they do immediately before they play dead, and they're hideous. Yeah. Possums can be, like, so cute and so hideous.
That's because, see, you look at the picture, this guy has a possum friend, and he's like, how's this? And he plays dead, and the other guy goes, no, open your hand a little. Okay, good. No, we could do better. All right, open your mouth, too. All right, you got it. Perfect.
So I've seen two possums. You know, this apparent state. The one was at my mother-in-law's house. They had dogs. I think the dog scared
the possum. Wait, don't confuse the possum playing dead for your mother-in-law. Thank you, Josh. Yeah. It was her mom I was just talking about.
Angry wife
in
the audience.
Josh, here.
Okay. So the possum, like, the thing looked freaking dead. They're good.
They are.
The curled lip sold it. You know, it really, I was impressed. I was like, are you sure that thing's not actually dead? Because I think the dog killed the thing. So we kept an eye on it, and the thing got up and ran away after whatever, an hour of being left alone. So then, like, a couple years later, my wife again comes in, we got, you know, our dog must have killed a possum. He's laying dead in the middle of the driveway. Will you get rid of it? I'm like, oh, okay, I've been there before, right? So I go out, and there's, you know, a possum playing dead in the driveway.
This possum, like, literally threw his intestines out. Yeah, right. Full steam.
So it turns out it was actually dead.
How long did you wait before you came to that goal?
Yeah, so I waited a couple of hours. I went out, I was like, shit, that thing is still laying in the middle of the driveway. It's, I guess
flies
it's,
are starting to get
right.
But
right.
I do think that's a good course of action. You know, if there's an insect in your house, a spider, a beetle, something like that, or you were handling it and then it fell on the floor and it looked like you killed it, don't like flush it down the toilet. It might still be alive. Just set it outside, let nature take its course, or let it fly away. You know, I think it's funny because possums are really good at playing dead, right? Yeah. Like they look dead. You know who's kind of crap at it are snakes. Have you ever seen a snake play dead? Oh, look at that. They don't look dead. They just look playful.
He's so faking it.
They just turn upside down and they're like, I think that's enough. It's good enough, right?
So my question is, when you encountered the possums playing dead, like, when did they give up the act? I mean, how much, you're juggling them around and finally it's like, all right, that's enough.
No. I mean, so you have to leave it alone. Yeah, it's not about, the more you interrogate it, the more it'll
stay.
Wait,
so if you're holding it, he'll just keep up the act to play dead and you're flopping them all around?
Well, and we talk about this like it's a voluntary, this is actually, like, for most animals, kind of a reaction. It's an involuntary action.
Voluntary.
Yeah.
Does it mimic rigor after a little while?
They look like they're
stiff.
In rigor.
They look stiff, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But snakes don't. Snakes just look like they're playing. He's adorable, right? Yeah. Aww.
Is that a frog?
Okay. Yeah.
A frog.
So like I said, some animals are better than others. Some just kind of flop onto their backs. And there's different reasons that scientists say that thanatosis occurs. Sometimes we think of it as being a defense mechanism. Like if I play dead, the predator's not going to want to eat me because if I'm already dead and they're not scavengers, it's going to be less appealing to them. But there are also examples of thanatosis for mating purposes. Like it's a way to say, it's okay, like I'm giving you permission.
So we're going to do science or fiction. Everybody's favorite segment.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge anyone who will play, which includes all of you this week, to tell me which one is the fiction. I don't have a theme this week. Sometimes I do a theme for special events. No theme.
Who's clapping for there being no theme?
Yeah.
We have a theme hater over here.
The theme ones are hard.
Do you guys like clap if you like themes for science or fiction.
Clap if you like sea pandas.
Yeah!
Much more popular.
Clap for anything, man.
Yeah, sea pandas. Sea pandas are...
Science or sea pandas?
That's sea panda is so much better than killer whale, isn't it? It's just a whale.
Orca.
And then it bites your face off.
Okay, here we go. As always, we're gonna poll the audience and see how you guys do. All right, first one. Researchers find that 30% of college students flush their unused prescription medication down the drain. Number two, a new study finds that simply wearing glasses reduced facial recognition by people to a statistically significant degree. And item number three, for the first time, engineers have created carbon nanotube transistors that outperform state-of-the-art silicon transistors. Okay, so very quickly, we're going to do the single clap method. If you think that the one about college students flushing their medications is the fiction, clap. If you think that the wearing glasses is the fiction, clap. And if you think that the carbon nanotube transistors is the fiction, clap. All right, little edge to three, but I think they were pretty even. All right. We're going to start with you, Brian.
Yeah, I'll
guys,
go first.
Guys, be quick.
Yeah, no, I'm just going to assume
the fiction.
The one that is most obviously true, because it seems like something everybody put in the news cycle, is the Clark Kent actually disguise works with the glasses. So I'm going to say that's so obviously, I'm going to say that's the fiction. It's too perfect.
Okay, Evan?
I'll go with the audience. Carbon nanotube is the fiction.
I'll say that flushing medication is a fiction.
Oh, we're all over the place, Kara. You have no help.
I'm going to go with flushing medication because I think that college students, younger people, would be more mindful of that than elderly people, for example. Because it's in the news cycle, because I think there's just more awareness around it now than there was historically.
All right.
And they're more environmentalists.
Normally, I would jump to the nanotube one as fiction because it's just... I don't think we're there yet, but I know you're just trying to trick me with that somehow. So I'm going to go with the medicine flush.
All right. All right. So we got the left side of the table is medicine. Evan, you were the transistor, and yeah. Brian was the glasses. So very quickly, again, did they influence you at all? Medication is a fiction. The glasses is a fiction, and the carbon nanotubes. Huh. Still three, but the medication definitely. You guys were definitely influenced by our panel of experts. So let's see how they did. We're going to take these in reverse order. Does it matter? Okay. For item number three, for the first time, engineers have created carbon nanotube transistors that outperform state-of-the-art silicon receptors transistors. Evan, you think that one is the fiction? Mm-hmm. About a good, you know, half of the audience, I think, thinks that one is the fiction. And that one is science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Science.
Well, yeah, this is...
How? Come on. How is it?
So... All right, here, I'll tell you how. So this is University of York. So the idea is that, you know, carbon nanotubes are semiconductors. They make good transistors, but they theoretically should be five times faster conductor than silicon transistors using one-fifth of the energy. Hmm. But we're not getting anywhere near that because it's hard to make them pure enough. Hmm. So, and for conduction time, the critical element is making carbon nanotubes that are free of metallic contaminants. So they were able to get the contaminant level down low enough that the conduction was actually 1.9 times higher than the silicon ones. Yeah. The contamination was down to 0.01%. So that's what you have. And at 0.01%, you're still only getting to about twice as fast. So it should be five times as fast. So there's still a long way to go. It's also, another, challenge is manufacturing them that are defect free. And so that's a really challenge. We can do that, but it's really expensive. Or we can make them cheap and full of defects. If we can make them cheap and defect-free and pure, then we're talking, right? So this is just one step in the direction of replacing our silicon, you know, transistors with carbon nanotubes. But we're not there yet. Okay. Let's go to number two. A new study finds that simply wearing glasses reduced facial recognition by people to a statistically significant degree. Brian, you think this one is the fiction. The audience does not think this one. Not on your side.
At all.
And this one is science. Sorry, Brian.
Yes.
All right. So I said statistically significant because it was. I don't think it was very clinically significant. So what they did was, actually the previous one was the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This one was the University of York. So what they did was they showed subjects pairs of pictures, two people, and they said, is it either, yeah, the same person or are they different people? And then people had to guess whether they're the same person or different person. If both people were wearing glasses or both people weren't wearing glasses, they were 80% accurate in saying that who they were the same or not the same. If one person was wearing glasses and the other person wasn't wearing glasses, that dropped to a statistically significant degree, to 74%, which is not that much lower. But they made a big deal. Oh, a 6% drop, but it was statistically significant. So while technically true, might have been a little misleading. All right, all of this means that researchers find that 30% of college students flush their unused prescription medication down the drain is the fiction. Carrie, you were right, because younger people are much more mindful about this. And also, older populations were told to flush their medication down the toilet, and then they may not have gotten the update. They didn't get the memo. They're not supposed to do this. So the actual percentage was less than 1%.
They're not doing it.
And the researchers were expecting a spike in medication in the system when they left home. So they were closing out their dorms. They figured they'd be throwing out their unused medication, but it didn't come. So they surveyed them, and there's like only less than 1% said they ever flushed their medication. So the word is getting out there.
Awesome.
Okay, so congratulations to the roughly half the audience that got that right. Congratulations to Jay Bob. And Evan, you are going to close us out with a quote.
Good grief. If we can't laugh at ourselves and one another in good spirit without malice, then what fun can be left? If we must withhold all ribbing in the name of protecting everyone's feelings, then we truly are a toothless society. George Takei.
All right. right, well, thank you all for joining me for this special DragonCon episode. Brian Brushwood, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, dude, always a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Enjoy the rest of the con. Thank you all, and until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.